Good morning. Good morning. Please be seated. The first case on our docket this morning is 53182, Davis v. Belling. Mr. Winterton, are you prepared to proceed?
Yes, I am.
And do you wish to reserve any time?
Yes, 5 minutes.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Justices. I appreciate the opportunity to be here and address this issue. This is a case in which the party that allegedly committed the fraud lost $150,000, and the party that was defrauded actually gained $250,000. That appears to be strange, and that's why I'd like to address three major issues in which we're filing this appeal. The first one deals with, we believe there's an error in regards to the disclosure of the duties of a realtor. Number two, there's an issue of mitigation, which would be a new issue before. There's no rulings on the Supreme Court on this issue because of the new statute. And three, about damages. But before I get into this, there's two foundation facts that need to be established. The jury was asked the question, do you find a false representation was made by Cheryl Davis? The answer was no. Do you find that Cheryl Davis made a promise at that time? She made it, and she did not intend to perform it. The answer is no. So any other if they say she made this representation or that, the answer is no. Everything she did was truthful. The issue before this court is what they're calling concealment, a fraudulent by concealment. Now, I'd like to go over the duties of a realtor because this smacks very to the heart of what this issue is dealing with. What had happened is there's a the Valdezes, there's a property called Valdezes. The Roses were buying a piece of property from the Byrds. The Byrds and Cheryl Davis was involved in that transaction. The Byrds then were buying the houses from the Beeling and Dougherty. And then from there, Beeling and Dougherty were buying the Ping property. And so there's kind of this chain. They're saying because Cheryl Davis was involved in the Valdez property between the Roses and the Byrds at the very beginning, way up there, they concealed that. And they said that was a fraud, and so they would not have dealt with Cheryl Davis, and that, as a result, they found her guilty of fraud. Let's go over the duties of a realtor. Under 645.251, it talks about that a licensee is not to comply with the principles of common law that may be otherwise applied in any other duties of a licensee. And then it says you need to comply, and it quotes with 252, 253, and 254. And that's the duties. So we go to section 252, and it outlines what the duties of a realtor are and what they're to disclose. Here it says that they're only to disclose material facts relating to the subject property, relating to the property that is the subject of that transaction. The only transaction they had was dealing with this Ping here. Beeling and Dougherty had nothing to do with the Bird and the Rose property. So she, by law, was not under an obligation to do that. Also, she is required to state if she has an interest in the property. She does not have an interest in the property, and that's important. But here they're saying that she had an interest in the transaction.
Well, wasn't her communications about the status of closing of the Augusta property in December wrong?
Pardon me, was the communication regarding the Augusta property
in December wrong?
No. She was correct, because you got to remember what the jury said. She never gave any false statement. The jury found that she never committed any false statement. And so, no, she was not wrong. She gave a status report of what was going on, and as a result of that, she even gave them the phone number and says, you call the title company, and you do all this. She also never stated about the full financial. That goes into the duties that I'm talking about under Section 252. A realtor has no duty to inspect the financial conditions of a party to a real estate transaction. She had no duty to do that. She knew about it. She told him about it. And according to the jury, everything that she told him was correct. She never said anything wrong. But they're saying they concealed the fact that she was involved in that transaction. You go on. And under Section 252, it's...
Well, I'd like to return to my question about the 2 or 3 days in December. I understand what you're saying about the jury's response, but what I understand from the briefs, and I'd like you to clarify,
sure,
is that your client said that the closing was going to occur, and it wasn't. Isn't that the case, that the buyer was intending to close, they were prepared to close, and in fact, Davis knew that they weren't in a position to close?
No, that is not correct, because first off, Davis never represented the Byrds. They were informed, and she was informed by the title company, that they would be willing to close at this time. And to go an extent farther, said, Mr. Daugherty, you don't have to believe me. Call the title company yourself, the person that was doing the financing, and find out yourself. So he did, and he got the same report. And so that's why, no, she did not say, they're going to close without a shadow of a doubt, this is it on this day, said that. Also, Miss Beeling on the witness stand said, I didn't believe Davis anyway. I didn't believe her. There's got to be an element of reliance, and there was no reliance there. So the elements of fraud were not even met. But the special verdict form went through all the different elements of fraud, and the very first question out of the gate was, did she say anything that was a false representation? The answer was no. So no, in December, when she said it, she was reporting what the title company had told her. They were going to close at this time. That also, that's what it says here, is the realtor is not liable for the statements made by your clients or other people. They only have a duty to report. And what you're saying is she actually reported on what her duty was. So she gave that material fact. Did that answer your question, or you have more?
I have more, but that addresses the question on that point.
Okay. The other issue that we're dealing with is, as it talks about under 252, when it also says that the Division of Real Estate is to put out the required disclosures and the forms. And that required disclosures and forms were prepared by the division, and they were executed. There's no question that they were executed and they were proper. But also, the required disclosures were made as per the division. So it's our position that the required disclosures, as required by the statute, have been met. And what they're arguing to the jury is that the disclosures that were not met, that were not there, have, well, they're saying that even though the statute doesn't require it, you still need to do this. And that's how the jury came up. What I'd like to do is jump over to the next issue dealing with mitigation. We believe that this case should, that the evidence that excludes a mitigation was an error, and that she should have been allowed to bring into evidence that she had someone that was willing to take the property. The Ping property closed. Then what happened is she had another buyer. You know, if you're not interested, prices are skyrocketing. If you want to take this off your hands and return us the way you were, I have someone that's willing to do that. And we believe that's mitigation instead of settlement and compromise. All the cases that I've quoted have put together kind of a summary of six elements that deal with the difference between an offer and compromise and trying to get it settled.
First, she had an actual buyer. It wasn't her efforts to buy it herself.
Yes, it was Randy Dorshow was the buyer.
Okay.
Yes. And what the situation is she said to determine if it's an offer or negotiation is who's making the offer. If the plaintiff is making the offer into court as evidence, he may be trying to prove liability. But we, it's the defendant here. And in the defendant case, that's not, they're not trying to prove liability. The statute says you can't prove liability or amount. Otherwise, it's precluded by the statute. But for other purposes, it is. It's coming from the defendant, so it's not liability. Number two that they said is, does it establish amount? There's no discussion of amounts. It just puts you back in the same place you were. It's got to be unconditional. There were no conditions. You release me and I'll do this or so on. It was totally unconditional.
All the earnest money would have been safe. Everything would have been returned to everyone, status quo?
Exactly. Exactly. And that's why we believe it should have been done. And that's Alva Holmes versus Merritt case that talks about that. The juror, the last thing is, public policy says you are entitled to have settlement. And here it says it's just the opposite, too. You want to encourage settlement, but then that person says, oh, this isn't reasonable, I'm going to go after you and reduce it. Public policy says they've got a duty to mitigate, and if they reject that offer, they're being unreasonable. And so it cuts both ways. And so based upon that, Your Honor, we believe that there's error because of multiple reasons, but the biggest things I wanted to talk about was the mitigation issue and the duties of the litigator, that there was no fraud that was met. And I'll reserve the rest of my time for everybody.
Thank you, Mr. Winterton. Counsel, as you approach, would you please pronounce your name so that I might pronounce it correctly?
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Brian Zeminski.
Zeminski.
And I represent Kristen Beeling, William Doherty, and the Doherty Family Trust. I'd like to first pick up on the issue of the offer of compromise first and correct some of the misstatements regarding some of the facts of this case, which we believe the trial testimony and the exhibits in this case speak for themselves as to the underlying facts and what the jury found. And what's important in that regard is that regardless of the number of issues that are raised by appellants in this case, none of those issues change the fact of the findings the jury made regarding concealment and regarding the breaches of the NRS 645 duties by Ms. Davis and Platinum Properties. Specifically as to the offer and compromise.
Are you agreeing with counsel that 645 abrogates common law claims?
I do not agree, Justice Hardesty.
What's your best argument that it does not?
I actually have a few. First is the statute they rely on.
Yeah, all you want. I just looking for your best one, but
I'll start with my best one and go from there. You may not agree what the best one is, but I believe there's numerous ones that are.
We have a laundry list.
A laundry list that
I'm just teasing you. Go ahead, Mr. Smith.
The first, Justice Hardesty, is NRS 645 2.51, which in its title says licensee is not required to comply with certain principles of common law. Appellants have taken this language of that statute and broadened it to that real estate agents do not have to comply with any common law. And we don't believe that was the intent of legislators. And specifically, if you look to NRS 645.252 and .254, those discussed in the context of negligence. So we would agree that Chapter 645 may have replaced the negligence cause of action and define the duties of a real estate licensee. And also NRS 645.253 and .254 also discuss fiduciary duty. We submit, as we briefed, that those are the two common law causes of action that have been abrogated by the legislature. There is no basis whatsoever to find that the legislature intended to abrogate concealment or fraud, or intentional misrepresentation.
Well, but the language is pretty broad here. Are you suggesting that the language itself is ambiguous and therefore the court should engage in statutory construction to resolve the ambiguity? It says a licensee is not required to comply with any principles of common law that may otherwise apply. Now, I recognize that there's a conflict between the language that I've just read and the title, But generally speaking, we don't examine the title or even consider it unless there's an ambiguity in the language of the statute itself. Where's the ambiguity in the statute?
There is not much ambiguity in the statute. It does say any common law. But then the other statutes go ahead and define what the duties are. And I believe also the secondary argument that within those statutes, there is discussion of concealment. Real estate licensee is under the obligation to disclose all material facts. And here, the jury found that she didn't, that Ms. Davis did not disclose all material facts, that there was concealment of material facts, there was expert testimony on that issue.
But that would make your claim a 645 claim for concealment problems, not a intentional omission claim under the common law.
Potentially, but I don't think the standard would be any different based on the special verdict.
But it affects your damages, doesn't it?
I do not agree that it impacts our damages because the damages flow in 0.257.
I guess the point I'm trying to make is, assuming that 645 abrogates a common law concealment claim, does it change the right of the plaintiff who has sustained an injury from concealment to the damages they're entitled to recover?
The answer to that question is no. NRS 645.257 specifically provides that a victim of a real estate agent licensee's breach of their duties is entitled to all actual damages. And that's exactly what the jury looked at here, and that's what they awarded.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we've got this big skirmish over common law versus 645 claim, but at the end of the day, I'm questioning whether it makes a difference.
We don't think it does, Your Honor. It's the damages are the same. The result is the same. The elements would be the same. There's a couple other points on that issue. In 1997, after the statutes were adopted, this court upheld punitive damages and a finding of fraud in the Buhecker case, and that's 113 Nevada 1147, in which they allowed a victim of a real estate licensee's fraud to recover from the Real Estate Education Research and Recovery Fund. I think that's important that this court has previously not completely abrogated common law in respect to fraud causes of action, at least in respect to the NRS 645 duties. In respect to the offer of compromise,
and I'd like some clarification on Mr. Winterton suggested that there was a subsequent buyer, and yet I think some of the record would suggest that Ms. Davis was that buyer. I'd like some clarity on that.
The record's very conflicting on that, and Mr. Winterton's statement today that there was another buyer conflicts with what the testimony was in the case. At one point, Ms. Davis testified that she would take over the property. That's what she testified to the jury in spite of the order on the motion to eliminate. But later during the proffer, she stated it was this friend, Randy Dorshow, who was going to complete the purchase. Curiously, Ms. Dorshow was never identified as a witness in this case, never listed as a witness in this case.
But the legal issue in front of us is whether the ruling on the motion in limine was an error. Why wasn't this evidence mitigation evidence? I'm concerned about that. That the jury was not allowed to consider that under a mitigation instruction. Why wasn't that error by the district court?
First of all, it's discretion by the trial court as to the admission of evidence, and we don't believe there's been any showing of abuse of discretion. Interestingly, this case had three judges handle it. We had Judge Villani pre-trial, who looked at this issue in great detail on a motion to eliminate. We had Judge Bonaventure during trial, who also looked at this issue and determined that that they were getting into settlement negotiations, that Judge Villani is right on point of Judge Villani's ruling. That's a quote. And then we had Judge Herndon, post-trial after the case was reassigned, who kind of, interestingly, basically served as an intermediate appellate court in this case, looking at these issues fresh. He wasn't involved, looked at them on a motion for new trial brought by the appellants, and decided all these issues. And while we have argued that there should be a bright line, that there's too fine of a line between mitigation and offers and compromise to ever allow it in. And here specifically, it did go to the amount. She testified that she said, I'll give you back the $25,000 that you put in for the pink. So there was discussion of the amount. But Judge Herndon, I think, eloquently put it in his motion, in his order for the motion for new trial, that as to plaintiff's arguments regarding offers of compromise as compared to mitigation, the court finds that sometimes the two can be absolutely overlapping, and sometimes they can be very, very distinct. Ultimately, the court finds that it is a factual determination to be made by the court based on what the trial court views the situation to be, and therefore how it could or could not be presented at time of trial. The court does not find any faults with the trial judge's belief, based on everything the trial judge heard and reviewed, that a subject evidence sought to be introduced by the plaintiff regarding plaintiff's alleged offer to buy back the Ping property was an offer in compromise, as opposed to something that is purely mitigation.
Well, Judge Herndon's eloquence, I think, stems from an absence of guidance on the law on mitigation in our jurisdiction. And counsel has cited a number of cases that set forth a series of factors that district court judges could apply in determining whether mitigation evidence is appropriate, while ultimately the trial judge is going to exercise his or her discretion on whether to permit it or not permit it, or permit the instruction or not. At the end of the day, there isn't a very good test here. Do you agree with that? And if so, what should the test be in deciding whether mitigation evidence should be permitted or not?
I agree there is no test in Nevada. There's actually no test in most of the circuits. I think you've seen from the briefing that there's been five circuit cases that have been cited by the parties. Two of them have established a rather bright line that the evidence shouldn't come in. Two of them, the ones cited by the appellants, say that it wasn't an abuse of discretion for the trial court to allow the evidence to come in. And one has basically said that if there's any doubt, you should sign in favor of excluding the evidence.
Yeah, but those are conclusions. In each one, they set forth factors that judges apply. We don't do that now, at least to my knowledge. And we don't give some direction to the trial court judges on how to make that distinction.
That's correct. But nevertheless, Judge Villani did consider some emotional limine, did give us some time, did hear oral argument on it. While there was no specific test that he laid out any order or to see what his thinking was, he did consider this issue, and he considered it carefully.
The reason I'm posing the question, counsel, and you both have done a good job citing these cases, I'm really proud of you there, but the point I wanted to make is, since it's an abuse of discretion standard, it would help the Supreme Court in evaluating and reviewing these decisions as to whether there is or isn't an abuse of discretion if you know what factors have or have not been applied.
Yeah, it's a very difficult issue in that regard. It's a very difficult situation in which to apply the test. It's kind of one of those things where you know it when you see it. And here we have a case of everything came crashing down on Cheryl Davis. Ms. Feeling had learned of all the lies and concealment, alleged lies, but the jury didn't find that there was intentional misrepresentations, but they were alleged. And on December 16th, Kristen Feeling was fully aware of Mrs. Davis's acts and omissions. So now we have the closing that's forced through by Ms. Davis. And now once this has all come together and Ms. Feeling has spoken to some of the other parties, she spoke to the buyer on the Augusta property, she spoke to the seller's agent on the Pink property. That's when Ms. Davis came to her house. She was confronted with all these lies. Ms. Davis testified she was hysterical and she was emotional, and she blurts out this offer, well, I'll buy it back. And that's all we have here. Judge Villani, I think, took that into consideration and whether that should come in at all. Also, we briefed at great detail the slippery slope we think this would take this court down in these types of issues of where do you draw the line? Do you let in an oral offer that's not made as a formal offer in compromise or as an offer of judgment? Do you allow in a formal offer of judgment? Do you allow in all offers of judgment? Do you then allow the doctors to submit their offers? I think ultimately this leads to...
But on a mitigation claim, the defense has the burden, all of which can be tested on cross-examination. But if you don't give the instruction on mitigation, the jury doesn't even get to consider it as a legal basis.
The jury here was instructed on mitigation of evidence. And that, not to get too far off this point, but that leads us back to the first issue on our cross-appeal, that the Dougherty's were precluded from introducing what actually was their mitigation evidence in terms of the Ping property, listing it for sale, having renters, and all the carrying costs. The jury was never allowed to hear that evidence. But despite that, the jury was instructed on mitigation evidence, and I think the jury understood what was going on. As my time is running out, I'd like to address the one other issue on our cross-appeal, and that's attorney's fees. The listing agreement between Dottie's and Ms. Davis and the brokerage specifically had a prevailing party's attorney's fees. The brokerage sued the Dockerties on that contract, and the Dockerties prevailed. They were excused from performance, as the jury found. However, when Judge Herndon looked at our motion for attorney's fees, he denied that, finding that there was no claim related to the contract, and we submit that was 100% wrong, that there was a specific claim. Also, all of this ultimately arises from the listing agreement, and Judge Herndon completely dismissed that and only awarded attorney's fees from the offer of judgment made by the Dockerties going forward. Are there any questions?
Not so eloquent on the attorney award, but eloquent otherwise. Is that the conclusion we reached for Judge Herndon?
Two different orders.
Understood.
Justice Ada, yes. So we submit that the appeal should be denied. The issues on cross appeal should be remanded with further instructions to the district court on the issue of the mitigation damages, the carrying costs related to the Ping property, and on the attorney's fees issues.
I do have one additional question. In our state, the decline in the market is a significant problem. There is an interesting question about whether or not that decline should be considered in the proximate cause evaluation of damages. Why shouldn't it?
It should be because they proximately and actually flow from the in this case, the plaintiff counter-defendants, acts of concealment, intentional acts. There was no superseding cause. While the diminution of value is an interesting question, especially in relation to what our market has done since then.
Please continue.
It is not, by definition, a superseding cause that the market declined. I view the market as a continuing fluctuation, and it's part of the consequences of when somebody commits an intentional act of concealment, that those damages flow from that act. The Dockerties did not want that property at that point, yet Cheryl Davis pushed forward, forced them into that property, and she should face the damages that flow from that.
Why shouldn't the editor be ordered in this case for the $150,000 that Davis provided for the purchase of the Ping property?
By its nature, that was an unjust enrichment claim, which rests in equity. It rests in fairness. The jury, quite frankly, did a pretty good job here. They went through a 27-page special verdict that was laid out with very specific questions and leading them to answer those questions. And respectfully, I think both counsel did a fair job at trial in arguing their cases. As to the unjust enrichment, the jury is sitting there and applying interest of fairness and equity. And it's up to them. They didn't have to award anything to Ms. Davis on the unjust enrichment. The testimony that we presented was that, and by Ms. Davis's own testimony, she put that money in as a loan for the birds. And we submitted that that was all part of the concealment. That was part of her act to force these escrows to close because she stood to gain $176,000 in commissions. And you've heard a lot about the domino escrows, but if one of those dominoes fell the wrong way, then potentially none of them would close. So ultimately, it was up to the jury to apply how it weighed the evidence. It could have subtracted her commission from the unjust enrichment. It could have applied any principles in equity. And generally, though, those issues are heard by the bench, and here they were submitted to the jury. And again, that's the jury's province. We've cited the case law that the jury has wide latitude in determining damages, and they did so there.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Winterton.
Thank you. Justice, I think I'd like to pick up on some of the questions that you've talked about and you asked, because I think they're right on point. One of the issues that you talked about is in regards to the decrease in value and the damages. And in fact, this court has issued a decision in regards to Goodrich versus Woolard. And in that case, that's what they talked about. And they did a fabulous job in this case. It's been quoted numerous times in other cases in regards to whether or not the decrease in value can actually be considered part of the damages. And what they said is there were two types in the court's explanation as to damages. One's benefit of the bargain, the other's out of pocket. And in this case, it's supposed to go with the out of pocket. And in the Goodrich case, they said out of pocket. And if you look at the NRS statute 645.257, it says if a realtor breaches his duty, then you're only entitled to actual damages. Actual damages, again, has been interpreted as the out-of-pocket damages. So out-of-pocket damages is what's to take place. In this case, they said what had happened is a guy had given a loan, and then the value of the property dropped, and there was an appraisal given. And he said, I relied upon this appraisal. You were negligent. I should be compensated for the decrease in market value because I never would have given that loan. And the court, in their opinion, says no. He says it was just, you can't predict that. The market drop cannot be predicted. So as a result, in that case, the Supreme Court said out-of-pocket does not include decrease in value, the speculation of the decrease in value. At the time they did this, the market was skyrocketing. It was going up. It was hard to get properties just because all of a sudden turns and goes down. That doesn't meet the proximate cause. So their measure of damages was an error in the court and should be reversed. A lot of other things that they talked about in regards to the instructions being reviewed, whether or not it should be mitigation or not, it went through quite a few judges. It's just the way the system happened here. The trial was actually heard by Bonaventure. Then it was the motion to reconsider was by Judge Herndon, great judge. Bonaventure's a great judge. All the judges are good. But what they end up doing is reviewing this, and it's a matter of Herndon wasn't there to hear the evidence at trial. Bonaventure was. And so he's relying upon what the oral arguments were. And we believe that the evidence is why I talked about the various steps that need to be made to determine whether or not it's mitigation or whether or not it is an offer and compromise. And we believe these outlines of these steps would be very important in this case, but for all future lawyers to know what are the elements of mitigation. And so we appreciate you hearing this case and in regards to damages.
Returning to your earlier argument, I understood your argument on the decline in value to be a superseding cause argument. Are you saying that the decline in value is a proximate cause argument? Or are you saying that it doesn't matter because the decline in value shouldn't be considered at all? The measure of damages is strictly out of pocket.
It's strictly out of pocket. And if you go back to your...
I'm just trying to clarify which one of these arguments you're landing on.
I'm landing on...
Please complete your thought and respond to the question.
I'm relying upon this case, which is the Goodrich versus Woolard case. And in this case, they said it's out of pocket. And they actually define what is actual loss from sustained as a proximate result of the defendant's reliance upon the representation. So that's the case that I'm relying on.
And your contention is that doesn't include after purchase decline in market losses.
That is correct. And in this case, that's what they said. They said that the actual decline was not part of it and could not be, and they did not award it because of that. It's a very, very well written, and it really outlines out approximate cost, actual, but for, and all those explanations.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
This case will stand submitted.